Late Thursday afternoon, U.S. District Judge April Perry ruled that the Trump administration's deployment of the National Guard in Chicago violated the 10th and 14th Amendment. She also cited a nearly century and a half old law, the Posse Comitatus Act, limiting the military's role in enforcing domestic laws. On today's Block Club Chicago podcast, federal defense attorney Mike Leonard on what the ruling says, what it means, and perhaps what's next. Mike Leonard, welcome back to the Block Club Chicago podcast.
Happy to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the ruling, I want to start with the lead up to this case in front of Judge Perry. Let's start from the beginning. Why can't the president, whenever he or she pleases, send the National Guard or activate a National Guard to help out or do something or anything that they want in a city? What is the mechanism that prevents that?
Well, the Founding Fathers were worried about that issue in terms of using military force against individual states. And also, there's a law that restricts the president in how and when he can use it. So basically, rebellion, invasion. And then there's a third clause, which is a little more ambiguous, but it basically says if the regular forces aren't sufficient to execute the law, which to me means the regular military forces, doesn't mean the National Guard, but really what the administration was trying to focus on was they're trying to characterize this, they're trying to shoehorn in it as a rebellion, which is a tough sell.
And some of this is rooted kind of in constitutional law, separation of powers and the 10th Amendment, rules in the 14th Amendment, of course, amendments passed during the Civil War, and Posse Comitatus. So we have kind of a long, these aren't new rules or regulations. These have been tried and tested many times before, I'm sure, in the past 150 years for Posse Comitatus and 250 years since the start of the country.
Correct. Yeah. But I mean, we haven't had a situation like this where you can't really think of a situation where the states push back. Hey, we don't want the National Guard here, because typically they're sent out not to do law enforcement activities. They're there to keep the peace and to do really what are sort of tasks associated with hurricanes and things of that nature, you know, where it's for the common good. People want them there. They don't want them to do law enforcement. They're happy to have them to do other tasks, but not to do that.
What was the argument for the government? That what was happening in Broadview specifically at the ICE facility was chaotic and troublesome? Or was it an argument even wider about Chicago on the whole and the need for the National Guard to be there?
Well, they had to be careful. They couldn't make the argument that it was Chicago on a whole, that it's Chicago as a whole, or that crime in Chicago is big or something like that. That would be a losing argument and a bad position to take.
Why?
Because remember, the National Guard can only be federalized in certain instances. So what the administration chose and the lawyers chose to argue is that this really was a rebellion or a threat of a rebellion. That's kind of the poison they chose to take to try to sell the court on the idea this was really a rebellion, which doesn't really add up, because rebellion historically has been a group of people rebelling against the government, trying to overthrow the government, trying to stop the enforcement of the government. So it didn't really fit the circumstances. So then what they did was they tried to rely upon some of the things that have happened here in Chicago, you know, the arrests, the protests, the incident where someone was boxed in with a car, the, you know, sort of a tangling with federal agents. But that's a far cry from a rebellion, an attempt to overthrow the government or stop the laws from being enforced. So I thought that was a very tough position to take, but under the statute, under the law, probably the only one they could take. It just wasn't very credible.
The rebellion that the government was arguing, that we are talking specifically about what's happening in Broadview. That's what they were circling in on?
Correct. Yeah, they were saying what's happening in Broadview in Chicago with respect to these ICE agents and the attempt to enforce the immigration laws is actually a rebellion. And they cited specific examples of violence against federal agents, trying to box their car in, you know, stopping them from doing their job. But that's those activities, you know, that's a good try, but that doesn't rise to a level of rebellion. And I think they shot themselves in the foot in some major ways. First of all, leading up to this, you know, you want to talk about 10,000 feet, Trump, the Department of Defense, other representatives of the administration, had made these statements leading up to really almost last week, talking about crime in Chicago, that we're going to go to war against Chicago. totally undermining the idea that no, we're not here for those reasons. We're here for to squash this rebellion against the federal government. So that was a big problem for them. Number two, they made a filing last night before this hearing in which they made these sort of turn out to be probably false or incredible claims that they had been asked to do things like take control and guard the federal Dirksen building, okay? Which was a statement that the judge found very not credible. The chief judge, Virginia Kendall, made a submission to the court saying that's just false. The federal marshals control the federal courthouse. No one has asked the National Guard or anyone else to protect our court building. That's just a false statement. So really, it put the government, the government lawyers back on their heels at the hearing today from the very get-go. It opened the door for Judge Perry to sort of question them intensely about the truthfulness of their statements in the submissions they made to the court, which is a bad place to be starting when you're coming into a highly charged hearing and one that you don't have a great constitutional or legal leg to stand on.
So did they ever admit that they were lying or that they maybe heard from third hand from one other person to another person that maybe they need some help? I mean, did that ever come to a resolution?
Well, I think the lawyer, it's here's the thing. The lawyer has a couple levels of deniability. So they can say, well, we were told by government officials or we were told by DHS that that was the truth. You got to remember also, this is not an evidentiary hearing, meaning there are not live witnesses testifying. So that probably would have been even worse for the government. But all you have at a TRO hearing is a lawsuit that's been filed, a motion in support of it that refers to the lawsuit. And then you have a response, a brief by the other party, sometimes augmented with declarations, meaning affidavits and other submissions. So we don't have live witness testimony. And that probably was good because if the government had to put these people on a stand and be subject to cross-examination, it probably would have come out very clearly that what they're saying is not at all true.
You bring up a good point. This is a TRO. What does that mean? How is this different and perhaps not as maybe, I don't know, grave or the gravity of like a merits-based discussion on the law and the regulation of the law? Do you kind of see what I'm
Yeah,
asking?
very good question. Very good point. So what happens is for TRO, first, you have to file a lawsuit. You have to have a claims pending, count number.
Temporary restraining order,
Yeah,
right?
but you first have to file. You have to have a lawsuit filed. You can't just
Okay.
have a freestanding request for injunctive relief. So you file a lawsuit. You have all these counts, all these claims, like, hey, we win under this amendment. We want win under this law, count one, count two, etc. Then, as part of that, you file a motion for temporary restraining order, basically saying to the court, hey, look, we have these legal claims. We have this lawsuit that we filed. We have a substantial likelihood of succeeding on the merits, and the city and state will face irreparable harm if you don't act. Because we're so likely to win, we want you to essentially rule in our favor, enjoin the troops from coming here. And then the case would have to be decided on the merits later with what I talked about before, an actual evidentiary hearing with live witnesses and all that sort of stuff.
So you file a lawsuit to say, we don't like this. We're suing the Trump administration for their order to perhaps have the National Guard come to Chicago. And now we're going to do this separate thing, this TRO, to then stop it from happening even before we go through the proceedings of the lawsuit we just filed.
Correct. And the idea is if you think about where this commonly happens, the most common injunction case is an employment case. Okay. Remarkably, that's when it most comes up, or a patent case. So in the employment case, hey, I leave the employer, I have a non-compete, I go to the competitor files a lawsuit, or the employer I left files a lawsuit, says, hey, you can't let that happen. We have this lawsuit against him. We're gonna win. In the meantime, we're going to suffer irreparable harm because he's going to take all of our clients and our data and our proprietary and secret information. Stop it. Put it on hold until you can decide the whole case because, Judge, we're going to win this case, essentially. So it's analogous to that type of situation.
So the judge today seems to have agreed with the Attorney General of the state of Illinois that, one, they are likely or perhaps likely to win on the merits, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, and that, two, there would be potentially irreparable harm if, while this was being decided, the National Guard was allowed to go in. So she's essentially saying yes to both things, and we'll know more on Friday as to the extent of what her order is. But that seems to be the lay of the land as it is Thursday afternoon?
Yeah, and she has to find, number one, that there is a substantial likelihood that the plaintiffs in this case, meaning the city of Chicago and state of Illinois, will ultimately win. They have a substantial likelihood of winning. And she does have to find that there would be irreparable harm if she didn't put a stop on this, didn't put a hold on this. So those prongs have to be met. And because she's already said orally that that's how she's going to rule, her written opinion is going to reflect that. And apparently from her remarks from the bench, she really took the defendants, the administration, to task, saying that a lot of their assessment, a lot of their assertions were not credible, meaning they're contrary to what the other information that was being presented to the court.
I don't spend a lot of time in federal court. You do. There were some pretty sharp quotes. She says the Department of Homeland Security's narrative of events is simply unreliable. She went on to say other things that quoted Hamilton, and just basically finding no basis in what the founding fathers had set up to make this make sense to have the National Guard coming here. Is that typical of a judge to kind of be pretty direct in these sorts of statements?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, you got to keep in mind that this is a huge issue, right? It's of utmost public importance in this state and in this city. So it's getting a lot of attention. It's a packed courtroom. The judge is going to be super well prepared and knows that what he or she says will be widely reported on. It'll be quoted. It'll be cited. So there's a different level of preparation, and there's the knowledge that there's a broader audience. So I think that always goes into play. And then the written decision, of course, is going to take those things into account and also take into account that this case will likely be in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, maybe next week.
Well, let's talk about that, because the lawsuit on the merits is going to work through the courts through its natural slower course.
Correct.
This temporary restraining order, which will get the official order on Friday, can be sped up and essentially fast-tracked, if possible, up to potentially the Supreme Court. In which case, in this administration, we have seen the Supreme Court say, look, we're not going to rule on the merits on this quite yet, but we are going to side on the Trump administration. Not in all cases, but in many cases so far in the second term, we're going to side with the Trump administration and let them play it out right now, and we'll decide on the case merits later. So while the judge tomorrow or Friday, when they issue the ruling saying that they're not going to be able to come into Chicago, the National Guard, this could fast track at some point up to the Supreme Court, and they could say, no, we'll let the National Guard in and we'll decide on the merits of this case potentially later.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. And here's why that's likely to happen, because the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, I think, already heard today the Oregon case, because the Oregon's part of the Ninth Circuit. So that encompasses Washington, California, Oregon. So that decision is going to come down in a very similar case. You're going to have the Seventh Circuit of Court of Appeals weighing in. They may come to a different conclusion. So it's going to go to the Supreme Court probably remarkably fast. And if we were reading the tea leaves, John, I'll bet you the Supreme Court says it's all okay and full speed ahead to the Trump administration for bringing the troops. That would be my prediction.
Maybe they may not ultimately rule that on the merits. As a pretty originalist court, I imagine they'd give some deference to Alexander Hamilton's writings and the rest of the Federalist Papers, etc. But they may say, for now, we will side with executive powers and let them do what they do in the streets of Chicago or Oregon. But you can let these cases still go through.
Oh, yeah. You're right. The Supreme Court won't be deciding the actual underlying cases. But let's face it, if the Supreme Court says, hey, the injunctions are lifted, let the cases go ahead at their own pace. Obviously, the Trump administration won because the troops are here. They're on the ground. They'll be here for months. The case will take months to more than a year to be resolved. And so it's a win if that's what happens at the Supreme Court level for the administration.
The other scenario, which I don't like to entertain, but could be possible, is that the president sends in the National Guard anyways. Well, the TRO works its way through the courts. I mean, then we'd have, Mike, I think, I'm not trying to be use too much hyperbole, but that's a constitutional crisis, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great point. The funny thing is, this morning, I was on a different program, not as good as yours, and that same issue came up. We were banding that about, like, what happens if, despite Judge Perry's ruling, first of all, the troops, my understanding is that the Illinois troops are already mobilized. The Texas ones are probably on their way, if not already here. And the question was, hey, What if Judge Perry says, hey, I'm going to enjoin you from using them? And the Trump administration says, like they've kind of been known to do, well, we don't care. We're gonna do what we want. That's gonna be a very interesting scenario if that happens, because the remedy when someone doesn't follow the injunction is to bring officials before the court, sometimes against their will, and find them in contempt. Okay. But that would be an amazing hearing. But how would you practically attempt to remove National Guard troops from Texas and Illinois from the scene? It seems to me that that would be an actual crisis.
Any other thoughts on any of this?
No, I thought it was a pretty, I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't able to sit in the courtroom today, but from all I've read about it, sounds like a really emotional, remarkable hearing in kind of a landmark issue, at least what seems like landmark right now, may not be with some perspective on this, maybe not, won't seem like such a big issue, but really seem like great arguments being presented, that the court really took an active role in questioning the lawyers. And I think you got to keep in mind that the draw for the judge was probably not a great draw for the Trump administration for two reasons. One, she was a Biden appointee. She was actually nominated to be the U.S. attorney for Chicago, meaning the head prosecutor, federal prosecutor. The administration blocked her. J.D. Vance and Trump blocked her from getting that job. She then became a federal judge, and she knows how police and law enforcement work from her experience being a prosecutor. So when they were making representations to her about what the state of the local police were and the state police, she knows how all that works from being in law enforcement. So probably a real bad draw practically for the defendants in this case.
Though one could argue there have been Trump-appointed judges who have ruled in similar ways against the Trump administration. I'm not saying that she showed preference or you're accusing her of that, but I see what your point
Yeah,
is.
and I'm not saying that anything she did or said showed any overt bias, but clearly, if you're picking a judge, you probably wouldn't want to pick her if you're the defendant. But like I said before, I mean, what really helped the plaintiffs in this case, if you happen to read, John, or look at the 69-page lawsuit that we talked about that was filed in this case by the plaintiffs, the city, and the state of Illinois, they were able to go on for like 10 pages with direct quotes from the administration, pictures and postings that the administration put up saying, here's what we want to do to Chicago. Here's what we want to do in Chicago, which some of these posts were just days ago. So it makes it hard then for their lawyers to turn and say, hey, look, our only intention in Chicago is to stop this rebellion against the US government. That really hurt them from the get-go. So a lot of facts and circumstances, I think, were in favor of the plaintiffs today.
So now we wait and see, huh?
Yeah, we'll get the written ruling apparently tomorrow. We'll be probably hearing this case in the Seventh Circuit next week. And who knows? Maybe, the fact of the matter is, the Ninth Circuit case, that could go to the Supreme Court right now instead. And that would put this case on hold. And the question would be, what's going to happen to the TRO entered by this judge in Chicago if the Ninth Circuit case gets immediately fast-tracked to the Supreme Court? So a lot could happen, and it might not even be this case from the Seventh Circuit that gets to the Supreme Court next week. It might be in the Ninth Circuit case.
My head hurts, Mike Leonard, but I appreciate you breaking that all down for us. Thank you.
My head hurts too, but it's always good to talk to you, John. And you don't make my head hurt.
That's good to hear. There was another ruling on Thursday from a federal judge saying that federal agents can't use tear gas, pepper spray, or other weapons against journalists and peaceful protesters. This after Block Club Chicago and others sued the federal government over its actions against journalists outside the Broadview ICE detention facility. It's a temporary ruling, and it comes after four Block Club Chicago journalists were hit by pepper spray bullets and tear gassed by federal agents. Also, an independent journalist was arrested, and a TV reporter's vehicle was hit with a pepper ball, covering her face in chemicals, all as they covered protests outside the suburban Broadview facility. U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis said, quote, "Whatever lawlessness is occurring is not occurring by peaceful protesters." She added, "Some actions by the federal agents clearly violate the Constitution." Also adding, "Individuals are allowed to protest. They are allowed to speak. This is guaranteed by the First Amendment to our Constitution, and it is a bedrock right that upholds our democracy. The order also requires federal agents to wear badges or other visible identification so the public can know who they are, with exceptions for those officers who work undercover. The order applies to all U.S. Department of Homeland Security agents, including ICE and Border Patrol, across the Northern District of Illinois. The order, now said to be in place for at least the next 2 weeks, until an October 23rd hearing to consider a preliminary injunction in the case. Of course, we'll keep you posted. For more, head to blockclubchicago.org, and I'll link to the story in the episode show notes. Till next time, I'm John Hansen. Next podcast scheduled for Tuesday, or whenever a big story breaks.